This morning our Dharma talk will be given by Banlasway Zen's senior Dharma teacher, Steve Wallace.
Thank you. wonderful to be here with all of you. I think this is like day 9 or 10 for me. I, for some reason, thought it would be a good idea to, the 2 days before this retreat started, to do a 2-day retreat in Cambridge. So it's been a busy week and a half. So I wanted to continue looking at our text here from Master Lin Ji. And when I first read through this material in preparation for coming here, there was one particular line that kept jumping out at me. And I found it quite disturbing. So I had never really encountered Master Lin Ji's teachings directly. I had some ideas about the differences between our Japanese, what we call Rinzai Zen, which is founded by Master Lin Ji in China. And our Soto lineages that we perhaps talk a little more about, the Zen of the Japanese master Dogen, who brought the Chinese Chan to Japan. So I had these ideas. And when I read this section where it says, whenever wrong thinking does not arise, there is liberation. And associating Rinzai Zen with a lot of shouting and hitting with sticks and a great trying, a pushing for something, perhaps an experience. And when I read this, whenever wrong thinking does not arise, there is liberation. It sounded to me like it was suggesting that if only we could stop our bad thoughts, then we would see the true nature of reality and all would be well. And so this is a very attractive idea. You know, I recognize that a lot of my thinking is wrong or bad. A lot of it is quite disturbing to me, and when I vocalize and act out those thoughts, it's also disturbing to others. You know, so if I could just simply stop this bad thinking, it seems to me that that would be quite a wonderful thing. To no longer have bad, wrong thoughts. I guess at some points in my practice, I have tried to suppress thinking by various techniques of focusing on the breath, perhaps. Or something else, where my goal was to just be in the moment and hear the sounds and which is a wonderful practice, by the way, but if it's taken up with a goal of suppressing thought, I find it not to be terribly effective, because these stubborn thoughts keep showing up in my mind. They just keep on arising, and I seem to be powerless against them. So where does that leave me if I can't stop my wrong thinking? So I wanted to read the paragraph that sentence is from in another translation by Burton Watson. So this paragraph in his translation reads, "Followers of the way, this thing called mind has no fixed form. It penetrates all the 10 directions. In the eye, we call it sight. In the ear, we call it hearing. In the nose, it detects odors. In the mouth, it speaks discourse. In the hand, it grasps. In the feet, it runs along. Basically, it is a single bright essence, but it divides itself into these six functions. And because this single mind has no fixed form, it is everywhere in a state of emancipation." Everywhere in a state of emancipation. Why do I tell you this? Because you followers of the way seem to be incapable of stopping this mind that goes rushing around everywhere looking for something. How well that describes me. Incapable of stopping this mind that goes rushing around everywhere looking for something. So you get caught up in those idle devices of the men of old. So I hadn't really heard that line at the end there, you know. So you get caught up in those idle devices of the men of old. And in our translation that we've been using by Thich Nhat Hanh, he says, whenever wrong thinking does not arise, there is liberation. What do I mean by that? It is only because you have not been able to put an end to seeking that you fall into traps that the ancient ones have spread out for you. And at some point yesterday, suddenly I heard this line. And I think a couple of days ago, David referenced this line, and he called these traps glue pots, I believe, set out by the ancient masters, the teachings of our Zen way, these ancients who, I would add one word here, that the ancients have compassionately spread out for you these traps. For those of you who are unable to stop your wrong thinking by any technique, perhaps it's our searching, our needing that brings us here. It certainly was for me. This idea that something is missing. We talked about, you know, no lack, and that doesn't mean that we don't have a sense of lack, does it? And this sense of something lacking brought me to Zen. Blinded by passions, as we read in the reading from Shimron. I stumble around blindly, and if I am really lucky, perhaps I fall into these traps compassionately set out by the masters. So Melissa used this lovely image, I believe it was yesterday. I think it was from a cartoon of a person desperately clinging to a stone, not wanting to let go, needing to hang on for dear life. And then you see that this person is clinging to this stone as they sink in the ocean, and this stone that they're desperately clinging to is dragging them to the bottom of the ocean, where perhaps our ideas of self finally die, and we surrender completely if we're lucky. We give up. And in that moment, something finds us. But let us not romanticize this this failing and needing to ride all the way to the bottom and die before we do anything, right? Because sometimes we can just let go, can't we? And it's hard to know, you know, which is better. Would I have been better off to let go of the stone a couple feet under the surface of the water and swim to the top? Probably. And by all means, you know, if we're able to let go, you know, if we're able to see the problem, this is our awareness practice, isn't it? To be aware of our wrong thinking and to correct it when we can. What a wonderful thing. But sometimes we simply cannot see. We are blinded by these passions. And we are dragged all the way to hell by our desperate need to hang on to something. And perhaps we find the bodhisattva that lives in this hell realm that we've fallen into. How wonderful. Not the easy way by any means, but nice to know that this is one way. So, clinging to the rock or letting go, which is the path of liberation? Clinging or letting go? Liberation can be found in both of these directions, it seems to me. So, I guess I would recommend, if we're able to let go, to let things just be. Wonderful. By all means, let go and swim to the surface. And if you find that you simply cannot let go because you so desperately need to hang on, then by all means, hang on. Hang on. Either way. Either way. So, in this little piece I had us read from Shinran, a completely different form of Japanese Buddhism, Shin Buddhism, that is all about great compassion and faith, and the complete opposite of my impression of Rinzai Zen, right? So Rinzai Zen is all about working hard and accomplishing, and Shin Buddhism is all about nothing to do, you know. The compassion always surrounds me, no matter what. Right? Even when I don't see it, it is there. Shinran says, although my eyes, blinded by passions, do not see the brilliant light that embraces me, the great compassion never tires, always casting light upon me. So, this is my experience of when I am most desperate and unable, and the clinging finally kills me, that perhaps I'm able to see that at the heart of the universe is this great compassion, this great aliveness, this this joy, this ecstasy. Mostly I don't see it, but in some moments it does seem that way. And perhaps slowly we build some faith that this is always there, whether we see it or not. Thank you. So, this is an opportunity for discussion of the Dharma, questions, resonance, complaint.
There is the great compassion everywhere that we can count on. But nevertheless, at least one time every day we say, my deeds are my closest companions. I am the beneficiary of my deeds. My deeds are the ground on which I stand. There must be some configuration in which these two halves make a whole. Can you help me see that?
So, causes and conditions, right? Karma. This is the law of the universe, right? And it's, you know, so one aspect is evil karma created by me and by other human beings, right? So that's one side of it. But also there's the other side of that there are natural disasters, there are earthquakes and tornadoes and floods that might kill people that we love, right? And this is, you know, perhaps quite unfortunate, but nonetheless, the universe does seem to actually, to me, to have this compassion, and when we touch into this this one thing, I think this compassion may arise for us. This is the in Zen we talk about, in Japanese Zen anyway, we might call it kanseon, hearing the cries of the world, right? And suffering along with us, and doing what can be done. So people who hear these cries enact the vow of kanseon, and rush out to help when they can. And this is the sort of compassion that we're talking about here, I think, as it manifests in us as human beings. It doesn't mean that there's some magical being that is going to prevent bad things from happening to anyone that we love, because that simply is not how the universe works, unfortunately. I have for much of my life thought, you know, if I were in charge of the universe, I would create a place where these bad things did not happen to people, or at least the ones that I care about.
Maybe not other people. Yeah. That's another story.
Yeah. But nonetheless, no one asked me, and that is not actually how the universe appears to work.
It may even be a good thing that
it could be.
The universe doesn't work that way.
But those are the kinds of promises that many religions make. If you follow these guidelines, then you will be one of the elect, and all of your suffering will go away, and those other people who aren't really human beings will suffer instead. Not the Zen way.
The other thing, Susan, that occurs to me is important to remember that none of these teachings are true.
Right, so we want to put it together, and what's the, you know, what percent here? This is 52% of this, and then you add the 7% here. So they're all pointing to something, and often pointing from different directions. There's a lot of contradiction to the rational mind. So a wonderful question, you know, well, what is this? And what I love about Steve's talk and what he's saying is that it's really about how does it appear to us? So how is it for you? Where do you encounter the compassion? How is it when you enact your life in walking or sitting or ringing the bell? So they're all, we should be careful not to believe these teachings or put our faith in these teachings, and I think Linji so wonderfully reminds us not to do that. There's something more, much more reliable than any of these teachings.
And Linji also is very clear about these different views, right? So we've been talking about the different bodies of the Buddha, and you just named two of them. And Steve's talk was really about one of them. And when we talk, we because of language being dualistic, we can only come from one place. And sometimes we get we hold on to views like that man holding onto the stone. So this view of the world made of compassion, and at the center of it is this joy. That's the Sambhogakaya view. That is the view of the bliss body of the Buddha. And when we open to it, it's so delicious, and sometimes the form level grabs us back out of it. No, life is terrible, but then it can't help but persist. And you were also bringing up the Nirmanakaya view, which is the activity body. So it's not that these two things are in contradiction. They're actually they interplay beautifully. And then of course, there's the Dharmakaya view, which is the heart of the universe is nothing. Nothing at all. And all of these things that keep arising have no root in anything. And so if you became addicted to any one of these three views, it would be a problem, right? If it's only the Sambhogakaya, then when things aren't blissful, then you think, I'm doing my practice wrong. This is terrible. I'm a failure. I just am so stupid. I'm blah. Where's the joy? Where's the beauty? If we're only into I got to do things right in the Nirmanakaya view, we might miss all kinds of other things, like the joy of making mistakes, right? And in the if we're addicted to the Dharmakaya view, that's the most dangerous one of all, in a way, because then we can become very depressed and misinterpret that as if there's nothing, then why do anything? Life sucks. And in other words, we human beings are always inflecting things. So we'll inflect these three bodies, and the freedom that Steve was really talking about, I think, and I appreciate it so much. The Burton Watson translation you found, because I think that says it. At least I like it better because it's constantly around all these things. Sometimes this, sometimes that, and our life of practice is to be fully liberated into whatever view we happen to be in and not cling to it. Or as Steve said, if we're clinging to it, just notice that we're clinging to it. You know, that's the promise. So what a wonderful pointing out. Thank you.
And if you can bear to continue this for another moment. As Melissa was saying about the Nirmanakaya view, I mean, I think it's very natural to treat this, my deeds are my closest companions, in a Nirmanakaya way, and to think of it as, well, I need, you know, to follow the precepts and, you know, causes and conditions. And when David just asked, so what's it like for you, you know, when you walk and when you play the bell? And I just recently have been thinking about this line, you know, my deeds are my closest companions, in a way of, so when I walk, isn't that my closest companion? You know, when I don't hit the bell, but if I were to, you know, isn't that my closest companion? You know, so it's not like doing the right thing. It is just being close to, because what is my life other than me acting in it, you know, and to see that intimacy as that's my closest companion, and it's, you know, lovely.
When I hear the three different bodies, I can't help but kind of think, like, where's the suffering body? Or like the appreciative body and the activity body and then the nothing body. Mm-hmm. But that where does suffering fit in there?
I think that, one, we can get attached to any one of these. We can also get attached to all three.
Yeah.
So holding them lightly. But in the appreciation body, suffering is appreciated. Mm-hmm. Right? We receive our heartache of not being near the people we love. And then that is the appreciation body. And that opens us. And we see the great light in our tears. Not through our tears into something else, but in the vividness of it.
And you know, this is related to something Fran brought up yesterday. In the Nirmanakaya body, suffering also arises, because those are the two inflected bodies, right? So it arises, and then we see what to do, right? We see how to proceed. So in the Sambhogakaya body, there is this, you know, just vast appreciation. Here it is. But in the Nirmanakaya body, we get to go to we actually have a choice about how to respond, and it's so, you know, you can't hold all these views intellectually, just so, but every time we shift view. We can see, if we only live in the effective world, the action world, then suffering's a real problem. In the Sambhogakaya, it's not a problem in the way that David just beautifully described it. And in the Dharmakaya, there's no suffering. The whole Heart Sutra is sort of a Dharmakaya view. Like, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not, it's not, it's uninflected, there's nothing. But we couldn't live in any, we do sometimes just live in the Nirmanakaya. And we miss out Shinran's view of this beauty. Or we might just be stuck in that beauty, endlessly appreciating everything that arises. So it's, again, not clinging to any view, and also seeing that views arise. It's not a static practice, which I think is good.
There's another teacher, Arnie Mandel, who I've worked with some, and he's not a Buddhist, but comes from a very holistic place, and he talks about three levels of reality. Consensual reality would be his Nirmanakaya, where we do things, and then beneath that he calls the dream world the Sambhogakaya, all the things that appear, feelings, the thoughts that flit through your mind, all of that, and then beneath that the source world, this world that cannot be spoken of. And his teaching is that if we spend too long in consensual reality, we get depressed. Because there's always too much to do. Right? You may notice it. But that all three of these bodies, consensual, dream, and source, Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya, are all present all the time. And one is not better than the other. But
right,
Melissa
right.
keeps reminding us, right? Mm-hmm. All present.
And you know, there's all this stuff that points to, in the Wheel of Life and Death, six realms that go round and around and around. In some paintings of that, right in the middle are depictions of the three poisons, which keep the wheel going. But in some other depictions, there's nothing in the middle, or sometimes a mirror. And so we say that Dharmakaya is also like the great mirror reality. So we say the jewel mirror samadhi that we, you know, the we sang about it the other day, the song of the jewel mirror samadhi. This complete, it's not just uninflected, but it reflects back. Mm-hmm. And there's some way of understanding also the Dharmakaya as the great mirror reality, the source world, as Arnie says. Everything arises out of it, but it isn't anything itself. And you can't conceptualize it, and yet we will try to do it because we're human.
Thank you, Steve, for your talk. Something a little different sort of has stuck in my mind after the talk than we've been talking about. The other day we were talking something about settling or something about things have to come to you, and you can't force it. Things have to kind of settle out on their own. And this image came then that often comes to me. I heard it from some, some teacher or something, the mud, can you sit and let the mud settle till the water is clear? And that always, I love that, because it just brings this openness, this openness and freedom. But then I would try to make that happen. You know, like that should be my experience. But the stuff that needs to settle, you know, like talking about holding on to the rock and dragging down to the ocean, like you have sometimes what comes up and needs to settle, you know, for me, but I think for everybody, is you know, black and stormy, and there's blood mixed in with it, and it's just, you know, and that is part of what has to settle. So I don't know. Adam?
Thank you, Jason. I'm just, so what you say is entirely true, and I would just caution us not to think that we know that it has to be a particular way. Right? So sometimes we need to go through this darkness and blood in the water before we turn around. Right? And sometimes we don't. Right? We can romanticize that, right? And think that we know what the answer is, right? And that we need to push forward through the difficulty and get bloody in order to achieve anything, right? And there's a little arrogance in that, you know, we know, right? And we actually don't know, do we? At least that's how it looks to me. We don't actually know. And sometimes, you know, if you can let go and not get bloody, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you can't let go and you do get bloody, yeah, okay. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, choose up. Mm-hmm.
Which is better? Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Right? Do what you can. Do what you can. And I prefer the way of less difficulty and pain, if at all possible, but that's just me, you know. And sometimes I definitely don't do that. Right? Yeah, right. The teachers can attest to it, that that is often not my way.
And so sometimes we actually prefer.
We do. Yeah, it's attachment to struggle and pain, isn't it? It is for me.
Yeah, and just fine.
Just find either way.
But to see it, right? Because Wu Men talks about making waves where there's no wind. We have some masters of that in the house. And even more, he uses the phrase, more to the point of what you're saying, gouging a wound in healthy skin. Right? We do that. And we love it. You know, there's something about we've been talking about how sometimes life is sort of, you know, if we get too much in equanimity and emptiness, everything's, that. Where's the drama? So we become addicted to drama. Sambhogakaya gives us some drama, but yeah, we generate a lot of drama. And you know, the teaching that you quote, it's from the Tao Te Ching, which is a Taoist text, which is one of the roots of Chinese Chan, along with Indian Buddhism and Confucianism. And there is a lot of orientation in that path towards purification, so that you can live for hundreds of years. You know, that, and you see some of the vestiges of that in modern times with some of these. You know, they'll tell you, if you practice this, you get that. And I think that's what Steve was warning us about. And my experience when I try to let the mud settle, you know, is that trying to let the mud settle agitates the jar. So it's like this endless loop of, I'm trying. And it can just be endless.
And yet, sometimes, you know, it's this Soto Rinzai, mm-hmm. and, you know, that you're pointing to, trying really hard and not trying, and we can try hard not to try, you know, and sometimes we are able just to sit in the middle of it without holding, without making it a strategy. I think that's what you're talking about, Melissa, when it becomes a strategy.
But I think what you were talking about, Steve, was this great faith, which is so much a part of the Shin tradition, that and actually it's apparently part of the Linji tradition too, that things will come to us, that all we have to do is cooperate. So this sitting practice that we're doing makes transcendence, as James said in his talk last night, quoting another part of the Linji loop, transcendence comes to us. The mud settles on its own. It's most of this is not up to us. We get to do these a few actions, but mostly we just are cooperating with something much bigger, undefinable, and as Steve said, compassionate on some level, and also on another level, just causes and conditions interacting.
It also brings up for me this sort of mind like the moon, right? This sort of that the teaching is that clarity is always there, right? And so, you know, the mud is stirred up, right? And then it's clear as mud. and you know, to you know, and then that's what's coming to you. And that's the transcendent, right? And so these moments, these great moments that we label as, oh, but that's actually clarity, right? Like, you know, drink deeply of that when it's around, right? Because that is some yummy stuff. And then when it's muddy, right? It's not. It's the clarity is still there. It's still the transcendent coming to you. To not turn away from any of it. You know, again, the intimacy, the bottom line.
Clear mud.
Clear mud.
And one time I was asked to teach meditation to a summer camp for young children, summer sort of daycare, very young children, maybe 5-6 years old. And one of the practices was a Thich Nhat Hanh exercise. And so we took a big bowl of water and we put different colored sand into it. And then the children went around and they, like, stirred the sand, so it got all muddy, you know, and they would, we had, like, black and white sand, and, you know, black would be sort of, you know, if you're feeling sad, and white would be if you're feeling joyful, and just one little boy went up and said, could I put both in? But then just watching them, you know, as the water stopped stirring just on its own, and the sand started settling to the bottom. You know, they're little children, so they didn't strategize about this. They didn't try to conceptualize it. They just very happily and joyfully watched how it happens. You know, it actually settles.
Whoa.
Thank you for that image.
And it didn't take years.
And Jason, your question reminded me of something we read the other day from our liturgy book, the Master Dogen, where in face-to-face transmission he says, this is a splendid opportunity for Buddha Dharma to enter into mud and water. How would we do that? Make the Buddha Dharma enter into mud and water? I wouldn't know how, but... right now in this moment is a splendid opportunity for Buddha Dharma to enter into mud and water, for us to see Buddha Dharma even in the middle of this mud.
So we'll sit for another moment.